We are proud members of the Spy Podcast Network. Find out more at www.spypodcasts.com.
Well, I think that, of course, one is trying, obviously, both as a writer and now appearing with you, in some sense, to sell oneself. The circumstances here are slightly different. But I have been through the circus of PR. I've appeared on television endlessly. I could write a kind of Peter Ustinov essay on how the Germans treat you, how the Americans treat you, and so on. And none of those people on the sort of walk-on part that you're given really invite you to be anything other than what the public want you to be. They want to hear whether you write with a red pencil or a blue pencil, or whether you get up at 5 or at 9, whether you're spoiled by success. And funnies about success are simply out of place. You can say you were spoiled before or you were vain before, but this is not what people want to hear.
This is the Le Carre Cast. Following the blockbuster success of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, the book went back to print before even published, made into a movie starring Richard Burton, TV appearances by the author. It's not an exaggeration to say that David Cornwell's life completely changed. Continuing to work for MI6 after the book's popularity was not tenable. He was rapidly outed as the man behind the pen name of John Le Carre. And he left the service to focus on writing full-time. Cornwell moved his family from Bonn to Zurich and then to the island of Crete to write his next novel, The Looking Glass War. At the same time, Cornwell began a tempestuous friendship with the married couple Susan and James Kennaway. James was also a writer, but the combination of the three was a powder keg. Cornwell began an affair with Susan, but at times seemed closer to James. The balance of power between the three would shift regularly, and eventually all three would write about their relationship. The pressure of various affairs and the success of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold proved too much for his marriage to handle. Cornwell took any business opportunity to leave the family. A profile of Cornwell and his family that appeared in Ladies' Home Journal in 1965 is a looking glass itself, with everything we now know about his life at the time shown in reverse. Titled John Le Carre, Will Success Spoil David Cornwell? It focuses on Cornwell's perfect home life, highlighted with pictures of him and his wife Anne and his children, appearing to be the epitome of the family man faced with a bewildering sudden success. From the article. Tall, dark blonde, and handsome, Cornwell couldn't help impressing American womanhood. Some members reacted immediately. He was invited to come up and look at etchings. Gracious hostesses asked whether there was anything they could do for him. Some, who considered attack the best defense, made bold moves across the dinner table. Cornwell gained the impression that this was an invitation into a sort of gymnasium where they practiced their own kind of sport. It seemed almost an un-American thing to turn them down. Now, there's a line that can be read two ways. The book Cornwell wrote at this time is very much a product of this angst over his success and married life. As my guest today puts it, well, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold had been seen as an antidote to the spy fantasies of Ian Fleming. In The Looking Glass War, Le Carre presented an antidote to John Le Carre. Cornwell was conflicted over what he viewed as the glamorization of espionage that even a tragic book like The Spy Who Came In From the Cold had on the public. In Looking Glass, he was attempting a course correction to show that much of espionage is futile, that the costs do not always match the benefits. We also see Cornwell's own tenuous marriage reflected back in the book through several difficult romantic relationships, and none of the female characters come off in a particularly good light. It made for difficult reading. So much so that his editor asked for and received edits to lighten up the novel's relentlessly depressing narrative. The idea that it could have been even darker than the eventual novel we saw gives one pause. The profile of Cornwell in the Ladies' Home Journal ends with the line, "Will Le Carré's success spoil David Cornwell? I don't think so." Well, in the long term, maybe not. But in 1965, Le Carré's success made Cornwell's life very difficult indeed. Hello and welcome to Le Carré Cast. My name is Jeff and I'll be your host today. Each episode we take a deeper dive into all things Le Carré. And today I'm pleased to welcome Jeremy Duns as my guest. Jeremy is an author who has written both spy fiction and nonfiction, as well as serving time as the thriller critic for The Times. Jeremy, thanks for coming on to talk Le Carré.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
Now, today we are going to talk about a book called The Looking Glass War. A critic I respect wrote, "The Looking Glass War is a bleak and devastating read, but few other novels have so brilliantly described how a thirst for power breeds worlds of fantasy and failure." Now, Jeremy, is that a statement that you agree with?
Yes, I do recognize that statement. Yeah, that's from an article I wrote, I guess it must be 2 years ago now, in The Times. And I was trying, I guess, to sort of get more attention to, I think, one of the least known Le Carré books. I think it should be a better known book, this.
That article was what prompted me to reach out to you to talk about The Looking Glass War. But before we get into the book, I want to ask you, can you remember when you first read Le Carré and specifically what your first read of his was?
I think I first read Le Carré when I was 18 and I read The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and found it astonishing and was sort of immediately hooked by it. And then I read a lot of Le Carré in quite short order. I kind of overdosed on Le Carré. And then when I went to university, I studied literature, English literature at university. And by that time, I kind of had a reading list full of Shakespeare and Coleridge and Shelley and all kinds of other stuff. And I left behind Le Carré and Len Deighton and some other people I was reading. But then in my final year at university, I had to do for the course, I had to do two long essays, they were called special papers, and they were, you know, they had to be like focusing on one thing. And one of them had you had a kind of quote to go from, like the essay question was a quote from T.S. Eliot pointing out that melodrama had come to be seen as a kind of bad word. And in fact, if you look back in literature, it was, you know, all the best books were melodrama. Shakespeare was melodrama. Dickens was melodrama. And I used that as a jumping off point to write a long essay about Le Carré and Lawrence Durrell and Joseph Conrad, comparing the three of them, much to the horror, I must say, of my tutor. So then I kind of had an excuse to kind of study the thing that I really was interested in, if you like. Unfortunately, I've lost that essay a long time ago in technological advances. So I'd read him in a kind of one big gulp, and then that was, so maybe I was 19 or 20, that's when I kind of really sat down and kind of thought about Le Carré a little bit more.
Well, that's great. And, you know, I reached out to some folks on Twitter just to say, you know, hey, I'm rereading The Looking Glass War, and what were your thoughts of it? And so I got some responses. We had Micah in Ottawa said, read it recently, nice tight plot, good character development for its length, was panned when published, but it holds up. Certainly captures a particular moment in the Cold War. James Farson said, a uniquely depressing part of his oeuvre. Is that right? Am I saying that right?
I'm sure, oeuvre. Yes.
Oeuvre. Yeah. And that's saying something. Bloody good novel, though. Always twinned in my mind with Small Town in Germany. Mm. And Marge Wu said, really heartbreaking and reveals Smiley's capability of ruthlessness. Mm. And Paul says, a secret service of overprivileged public school boys guided by English exceptionalism, nostalgia for the war years, and delusions of grandeur. Le Carré remains scathing of this elite to his dying day. See comments on Boris Johnson, Brexit, etc. Just from Twitter, I think they kind of captured really quickly some of the themes that you see in the book.
They did. I mean, I'm not sure what I'm going to talk about now. No, but I mean, I think that's captured quite a lot of it. But I think there is a lot more to talk about, hopefully. But I mean, yes, those are all very, very perceptive statements about it. And I'm not sure. I mean, I don't really know. I haven't looked into it. How much was it panned? I think it got a kind of mixed reception, I think.
Yeah, well, I know in England, it got panned a little bit more than America. I did some looking in the reviews of American papers and only found a couple of real critical reviews of it. Everything else was pretty positive. I think it was in Britain where we really saw some negative reviews. Whether it's true or not, the interesting thing is Le Carre felt that it was really panned in England. And I think he wrote, this is in 1991, he writes, "I learned this the hard way with the Looking Glass War, which I wrote in the aftermath of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and which was received in Britain with such wholesale derision from the critical community that, had I taken it to heart, would have persuaded me to follow a different profession, such as window cleaning or literary journalism." So still being quite bitchy about the, yeah, the reviews that he got there.
There's a little bit, yeah, if he'd taken it to heart. I think he did take it to heart, maybe a little bit, judging by that little dig at the end there. Yes. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I thought that was funny. It was interesting when I looked at the reviews, though, the only two pans, and I can't, this is a sample size of, you know, 10 or 12, but the only two pans came from the two female critics that read it, which I wonder has a little bit to do with the way that the women are portrayed in this book, because... Yeah. I do think that that's a kind of a thing that I wanted to jump into a little bit later as well.
Yeah.
But let's set up the novel a little bit, because it's very structured in a way that we don't necessarily see in some of his other novels, I think. You know, it's split into three parts. Two of the parts are split into three parts there. It's the first is Taylor's Run, which is this look at this guy who's trying to pick up some photographic film, from a pilot who has taken some pictures as he did an illegal overflight. And then we go to Avery, who is sent to try and get this film from Taylor's body, basically, because Taylor dies. Spoiler alert, we will be spoiling the book pretty intensely coming up here.
Yeah.
And then finally we get Fred, is it Lyser?
I think Lyser, yeah, Fred Lyser.
Fred Lyser, Lyser's Run, where we see this agent prepped and sent over the border to try and figure out if there's really missiles in Germany there. So would you agree, from looking at his other books, is this kind of more fully structured in a different way than we see in other of his? I felt like, you know, part of the digs on him was this is trying to be literary. And I think maybe that kind of very structured look is where that some of that criticism comes from.
In a way, I think it is structured. I mean, I think, first of all, this is like Le Carre's at the top of his writing game here. I think the prose is extremely similar to The Spy Who Came In From the Cold in its tone. It's kind of much leaner in terms of the descriptions, perhaps not in terms of the dialogue, but in terms of the descriptions and the later work. It has a slightly similar structure to The Spy Who Came From the Cold, in that you have, you know, a man being trained, a British agent being trained by British intelligence to go to East Germany on an operation which is doomed. So you have a kind of slightly similar setup. I think the three-part structure, I mean, it is quite clever with the, you know, Taylor's Run, Avery's Run. You know, when they came to make the film, for example, the Taylor's Run bit takes place in 2 minutes. And essentially, I mean, in structural terms, I mean, I find this a really fascinating book, like in terms of how it's structured, how it's been put together, what the motivations for it were. But I think that if you were to write a film script, for example, thinking about what you would do, there's a structure. There's no real reason to have Taylor's Run. You could just open in London and they say, when Avery wakes up and says to his wife, Taylor's dead. I mean, that's kind of all you need to know. So instead of starting in media res, he has this whole rather long scene with Taylor in this airport in Finland. But it's a kind of virtuoso scene. I mean, I think in terms of the prose, it's one of the best pieces, it's one of the best passages Le Carre ever wrote. It's like amazingly well written. The whole opening is extraordinarily brilliant prose. But in terms of the structure of the book, I'm not sure we really need to know it. Although it does end with this. It's quite clever because Taylor's basically getting drunk. You know, he's getting drunker and drunker. And then there's a payoff in that he doesn't know which side of the road he's on. And so he gets run over by a Citroen. And much, much later on in the book, when Avery goes back, and he kind of meets the consul there. They get overtaken by Citroen, and he says, oh, it's these pilots. And you realise that actually what might have happened is that the pilot that Taylor met in the airport, Lansen, has then gone out to his Citroen. And then while Taylor is talking to the pretty hostess and everything, the guy has got in his car and he's been run over by the guy who was actually taking the microfilm off. But this is like quite a lot of the book is in one sentence that you kind of have to piece together. So there are kind of clues as to what's going on later on in the book. It is necessary in some ways. I mean, I think it is a much more tightly structured book than I had thought when I first read it. It's a very difficult book to read. It's a challenging book. It's probably the most difficult book of Le Carré's after Naive and Sentimental Lover to read. So from that perspective, yeah, it's debatable whether or not it's well structured. But I think there's a lot of extremely clever stuff going on here, and it's a little bit too much when you first read it. So it's a book to reread, I think, and appreciate that.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting that you talk about that, Taylor's death, because I think the book kind of hinges on that, and I think that's why he takes so much time to set it up, right? Because there's so much going on there. And I think one of the things, as I was looking through some of these reviews, they sent out, when people were reviewing it back in 65, they sent out a letter that Le Carré had wrote to his publisher talking about the book, and some of those reviewers referenced some of the bits of it. One of them says, this is a quote from Le Carré, he says, "There are deliberate ambiguities in the plot. Some become resolved. Without this riddle-solving explanation, each reader must decide for himself whether Taylor was murdered or died accidentally, and whether the indications of a rocket installation are true or false." So, wow. He really wanted to try and play up, force the reader to do a lot of work in the novel.
I mean, I think that's really interesting, because I think for me, I don't know about you, but for me, there's no doubt that there's no rocket installation, and that Taylor, it was clearly a hit and run car accident.
See, now I wanted to push back on you on a little bit about Taylor, though, because, you know, we see, as the book goes on, Control kind of masterminding this whole thing from afar, right? And he's shut down the passport number before Taylor even leaves. So Taylor is basically blown before he gets there, right? And so is it possible that there's something even more nefarious going on there? Has Control, because it seems to me like he's already kind of blown Lyser's run ahead of time, right? I mean, it sounds like Smiley is indicating that he has, right? And so was he doing something similar even further back to really kick this all in motion? Because if Taylor doesn't die, does this move forward? And wasn't that Control's idea in the first place?
I don't think so. But I think, I mean, it's possible. I mean, I think, you know, if we look at the context of the book, I mean, all of the stuff with Control and Smiley was added after he wrote the book. So this is the only book, according to Adam Sisman, that Le Carré ever revised radically on the suggestion of an editor. So Jack Geoghegan, I think his name is pronounced, but I'm not sure, but it was the American editor who kind of spotted The Spy Who Came From the Cold, which of course became this worldwide success. And then he gets this as the next book. And he says to Le Carré, this is too dark, it's too bleak, it's too grim, it needs more. And so all of that stuff the circus wasn't in it. It was just the department. So Le Carré then revises it by adding that stuff. Now, it could be that it's that devious that Control has done that. But the reason I don't really think it is because what Le Carré was really trying to get away from here was the sort of chess mastermind spy image that he himself had set up with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Because this is his anti-The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Because he was kind of horrified that critics and the public took that novel as being a realistic depiction of espionage. And the kind of twist at the end of The Spy Came In From the Cold, where you realize there's an incredibly sort of elaborate operation that's gone on behind the scenes, it makes them seem incredibly clever and incredibly competent and brilliant. And I think the thrust of this book is really the opposite, which is they don't really know what they're doing. And so then, yes, he's added this thing with Smiley and Control. But I think that even to Smiley, Control does not really seem to care that much. I think it may well be the case that he wants to put the department to sleep, and that he has blown Lysa, and that he knows perfectly well about the training operation, not the training operation. But I don't think he cares enough about this irrelevant department to kill an agent. But I could be wrong. I mean, it could be that Le Carré had that in mind. But I mean, in the letter that you read out, he's talking about the puzzles of whether or not Taylor was killed and whether or not the rocket site is really there. And I think, for me, the first one is very clear, that Taylor is accidentally, he's on the wrong side of the road. And the second one, he kind of holds back a little bit further into the book. You kind of suspect it's not real, but it's not really until quite late on in the book where Haldane kind of looks at stuff that you realise, okay, this can't be true. But so I think if he was trying something more devious, I think he maybe wouldn't have put it that way in the letter. But I don't know. I mean, it's a fascinating question. It hadn't occurred to me that control could be that nasty. But perhaps you're right. Perhaps that's what he's doing.
Well, and, you know, Le Carré has later said in that introduction to the book that I read from a little bit earlier, he talked about regretting having the circus in the book and that it took away from his main thrust of what he was trying to do. And so I wonder, I could easily see that he regretted being too clever in trying to weave this bit in there, because you're right, he was definitely trying to show something, but he felt that putting the circus in undermined all of what he was trying to do, because it shows this mastermind, right? Even if you discount the Taylor part, he's still mastermind the other part.
Yeah,
and it still shows one of the services being clever, right? Which is what he didn't want to show.
Yeah, and I mean, Smiley puts it to him, and Control says, well, who on earth would do something like that? So he doesn't quite deny it, but he doesn't so it's not completely confirmed that he's doing it. It might all just be a coincidence. But yes, I mean, I think part of the issue reading the book now, because I suspect a lot of people, even Le Carré fans, have probably not read this book, or if they have, they read it a long time ago and were kind of annoyed with it. And the kind of subsequent success, I mean, I cast one of the people on Twitter that you mentioned had mentioned that they class it with A Small Town in Germany, which I think is true. I mean, this book, A Small Town in Germany, and Naive and Sentimental Lover, form a kind of triptych of failure, if you like, because Le Carré wasn't expecting with his first two books to make any big impact. These were just something he was going to do on the side. And then he has this absolutely mammoth kind of cultural changing success that makes him extremely wealthy with The Spy Who Came From the Cold. And it then takes him three failures, really, because, okay, they got some good reviews and obviously they sold well, you know, comparatively speaking, but none of these three books were anything in comparison to The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. It's not until after Naive and Sentimental Lover that he comes up with Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy that we then really have that's another success on the scale of The Spy. And so then you have the Le Carré we kind of all know and love, and that's when his career sort of resumes, if you like. And because that's got Smiley in and it's got the circus in, I think Le Carré fans come into Le Carré really any time after Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy are kind of hoping to have Smiley and the circus quite central in them if they're spy stories. And we never see any of these characters again. I mean, this is the end of the department. You know, these characters are introduced once. And if you read some of the Smiley books and you go back and read another Smiley that you haven't got, you've got the familiarity of the characters that you already met. You have to be introduced to a whole new cast of characters, a whole different section of British intelligence that you've never heard of. So it is difficult from that perspective. And I mean, I would compare this book, I think I'm probably the only person to make this comparison, but it reminded me of Nirvana, the band, in that...
I can guarantee you are definitely the first person to ever make this comparison. I can, before even hearing it.
Yeah. John Le Carré as Kurt Cobain. No, but I mean, how is he like Kurt Cobain? Is that similarly their first album, Bleach, they did as a garage band, you know, and they weren't expecting to go anywhere particularly with it. It was for fun. And then their second album, Unexpectedly Nevermind, is a massive global success. And what do you do after a massive global success? So they do In Utero, which is a kind of back to basics, let's get our punk credibility back. We're not going to compromise and sell out. We're not going to have any sort of, you know, pop stuff on this. And it's kind of like anti their own fans. If you like this, you know, you're not going to like the next one. And Le Carré's kind of doing the same thing. If you like that extremely clever, elaborate Secret Service stuff that John Le Carré guy came up with, I'm going to blow that all apart. It's really a blowing apart of everything in The Spy Came In From the Cold in terms of how he presents the Secret Service, because he takes away the entire dynamic that you really need in not just the thriller but in fiction generally of a resolution that satisfies, of a sense of competency. I mean, this is rather like if you had at the end of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Smiley unmasks the wrong mole, and Control then reveals actually it wasn't the wrong mole. There was no mole. There was never a mole. It's that kind of feeling when you get to the end of it. So when you first read it, it can be quite annoying because you're set up to think that they're okay. It's looking inexorably like it's going wrong, but something's going to turn right. It's when you reread it that you know already this is a satire and nothing's going to go right, that then you can accept it. But I think if you come to it from having read the other Smiley novels after this, it's difficult. The dynamic of the narrative is very difficult to fix onto as a reader.
As I was reading this again, I was like, wow, this is really his first run at changing the circus.
Yeah.
The department is basically the circus in Tinker Tailor, right? I mean, he's kind of like, he's taken that idea and remolded it when he does Tinker Tailor.
Yeah, I guess he felt that he had over-glamorized the circus. I mean, you do have in the first scene of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, or one of the first scenes when Lemus goes back to London and he goes into the circus, and Control has his kind of electric fire in his room with a bowl of water on top of it, and he's complaining about that it's cold. So you do have this feeling of a kind of shabby, slightly put upon thing. The key difference between the department and the circus is that you know, scene, Control then goes into a whole speech in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. He goes into a whole speech about a sort of didactic kind of lecture almost about the differences between the West and the East in the Cold War, and that the methods and the techniques might be similar, but that the cause, that basically we're on the side of angels, that we might do some sneaky stuff, but we're doing stuff for good. And that's the kind of traditional British self-image, if you like, the image from the war, that we were kind of amateurs, we didn't have any money, it was all shabby and everything was falling apart. But these guys, these boffins, some Oxford professor of ancient history could suddenly crack all these codes. And so the image is built on the fact that, yeah, but they were brilliant and that they were also good and they were right. And this is what he doesn't have with the department, because they're not good and they're not right. So I agree that he takes the shabbiness and more of the moral ambiguity about whether or not we're right from this book going forward. But this is still much more uncompromising than Tinker Tailor or anything else, because they are simply chasing shadows.
The other thing that I think he does very well is play with the fact that spies, for all of the glamorization of that role, many times are just as clueless as the next person, right? There isn't no guarantee of what you're going to do. There's no perfect, correct way to behave in these situations, especially when you're thrown into it for the first time, right? I mean, Taylor is not a real trained agent. Avery is definitely not. We see that in his scene where it completely falls apart. And Lyser, who is probably the best trained, quote unquote, one of them, is just completely loses it, right?
He loses it. Yeah, and I think there's this idea that, I mean, they're all bluffing, basically. I mean, Taylor is sitting in the airport trying to think of, like, what would happen if I told that woman who works for the airline that actually I've got some money in my pocket. So he's kind of in love with the idea of being a spy. And Avery also doubts the mission and has this kind of explosion halfway through the book. But, you know, he's an ex-publisher who's looking for a cause. Le Carre uses faith and religion throughout to equate to the espionage game. And then Lyser, I think his motivation is a bit more interesting. I think it's something to do with wanting to be British, wanting to be seen as having succeeded on Britain's terms. But with all three of them, you're right, they don't really know what they're doing. And I think the anti-narrative element of this, if you like, is he's exploding the myth of the competent spy, which really started with the Second World War. Like, as soon as the Second World War ended in the UK, you had, well, even before it ended, while it was going on, you had a whole series of films and TV shows and all kinds of stuff that really portrayed British spies as very competent and very good planners. So you always have the scene where they explain in detail, this is what's going to happen, this is your cover. When you get there, you will be met by a man in a green felt hat and he will give you this password. And they've worked out all the details and it's all perfect. And what you see in this novel is how many details you have to think of and how easy it is to go wrong. Tiny thing goes wrong, Taylor gets a bit drunk, he's on the wrong side of the road, and he gets run over. And that has a whole series of consequences. With Avery, it's sort of, I mean, it's hilarious. It's like a kind of Basil Fawlty scene where he turns up and he just hasn't thought about, you know, Leclerc has given him all of this kind of backstory that he's going to do and it's going to be fine, don't volunteer too much information. And then, of course, just a couple of questions and he can't explain how this guy was his brother, why his mother wasn't the next of kin. He has no idea. And then there's this amazing scene where he's in the hotel and he tries to kind of burn some stuff and blocks the drain. And you know, it really feels like Basil Fawlty or some kind of sitcom. And I think the message that Le Carré is doing is, as you say, it's human frailty, it's imposter syndrome, it's everyone's bluffing in this game, and there are no puppet masters who are absolute geniuses of this stuff. It doesn't exist.
Well, and I think that scene with Avery was the one that really hit me the most, because I was like, wow, I could really see myself in that situation. Yeah. You know, like, that was the one where I was like, okay, if I was thrown in there, this is exactly what would happen to me. I would. Yeah. You know, he thinks he's going in, guns blazing, he's going to be perfect. And at 20 seconds in, you already goofed things up.
Yeah.
And are going down a rabbit hole that you can't dig yourself out of.
It's quite excruciating, actually, the whole thing. Because it should just be an easy way out. But suddenly he finds that it's extremely socially awkward and he doesn't know what to do about it. The other kind of context, I mean, there's lots of different reasons I think Le Carré wrote this book. One of them is that he'd essentially just been fired because of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. We now, of course, know, and it's repeated everywhere, that Le Carré was an intelligence agent. But at this time, this was not really known. And I don't think it was really known that he confirmed that he had actually worked for British intelligence until maybe 15 or 20 years ago. I don't know. You would probably know more than me exactly when that happened.
It was right around 2000, I think, is when he was kind of saying that.
And obviously lots of people suspected it. But then again, there are an awful lot of people who have had very tenuous connections to espionage who have kind of, you know, like, what did he actually do? We now know rather a lot, basically, from Sisman and from himself in the Pigeon Tunnel, but mainly from Sisman, what he actually did. And, you know, he worked for MI5 and MI6. And he wrote The Spy Who Came In From the Cold while he was working for MI6. And the fact that that was, you know, such a success, and that his writerly cover was blown, we think, by Anthony Terry, who was a Sunday Times correspondent in Bonn and a friend of Le Carré's, who was also an MI6 operative. The fact that it then became, he couldn't deny this, it became clear that David Cornwell was John Le Carré, meant that he was called back to London by Dick White, the head of MI6. And you can't carry on a diplomatic cover. Your cover's blown. So he was offered to either be an academic or to be a journalist. And he was wealthy and, I think, annoyed, and he declined. And 3 months later, he's finished this book. So in a way, the kind of glamorization of the service that he'd worked for suddenly kind of turns on itself, and it's suddenly like, you're all basically incompetent fools. And he does not hold back. I think he denied a bit, but I think there is a little bit of kind of vengeance in this book, both against himself. Certainly there's a self-chastising element in Avery, which I think we can see as a John Le Carré stand-in. But I think it is also very, very eviscerating about the service that he just worked for. And then I think the other thing that was probably in the back of his mind was Our Man in Havana by Graham Greene. I mean, this is a very Graham Greene-ish book in terms of its prose style. And it's not as outwardly, openly funny as Our Man in Havana, but it's similar in a way that it is really showing the frailty of British intelligence. It is showing how a lie can get out of hand, how a fabrication can get out of hand. Our Man in Havana even has a car crash. One of Wormald's fictional agents who's made up, Raoul, is killed in a car crash. It's some other, you know, Raoul, and this kind of confirms his own intelligence. So I think all of those things play into the Looking Glass War.
Obviously, the service took that to heart, that he was bitter about things there, because he talks in the Pigeon Tunnel, I think he references, where right after the book came out, somebody from the service comes over and just calls, you utter bastard, at this dinner party, that is ripping into him about this particular book, because more than The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, this was the one that I think everybody felt like it was just a vicious kind of takedown of what they do.
Yeah, and I think over the years he has been criticized by lots of people in the espionage world as being nihilistic and portraying everyone as betraying everybody. He also talks in the Pigeon Tunnel straight after the passage that you're just mentioning, how Maurice Oldfield says to Alec Guinness when they meet for lunch with Le Carré there, well, you know, we're not like young David portrays us. I feel that Le Carré kind of played this off as a joke, and he said, in some of my novels I did portray British intelligence as being very competent. Yeah, that's true, but not in this one. I mean, there is no ambiguity here. I mean, this really is an extremely damning and cutting view of British intelligence. So I can understand the reaction that it got. And Le Carré claimed that, talking about the literary, the critical reaction, he claimed that, in fact, MI6 was so angry with him that they directed the critics to slam the book. He did that in an article in The Guardian many years later, which sounds fairly bizarre, almost conspiracy theory-like. But then when you think that Dick White, head of MI6, offered him a job as cover as a journalist, you know, yeah. can it be too hard to imagine that someone, if he had said yes, that Le Carré might have been passed a spy novel to review? You know, I think it's not completely... Perhaps I'm going into control being very elaborate here, but I think it's not completely insane to think that might have happened.
Well, and I also think it's one of those things where it doesn't even need to be as nefarious as that, right? I mean, the old boys school, you know, they go to the club, you know, oh, that Cornwell again is, you know, putting out another one of these, right? You know, and they're like, I could easily see that kind of happening, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't have needed to have been a memorandum. We hypothetically imagine Le Carré was offered twice, in fact, by Dick White, this opportunity to go undercover as a journalist. Sisman explains, you know, both of these situations, once when he was at Oxford and once after Spy Who Came In From the Cold. And both times the offer involved the idea that he could be a journalist, a left-wing journalist, kind of undercover. And yeah, of course, if there was some other Le Carré writing these kind of books, a word over lunch or dinner, it would have just been in the air, and that he could then have pitched to his editor, well, you know, perhaps I will take this down a notch, because he would have been an insider and he would have known what was expected of him. So I think, no, did they do, did MI6 have some kind of deliberate campaign to get rid of the Looking Glass War from critical attention? No. Could there have been some kind of nudges? I think so. One of the things that's interesting is it's really disappeared from cultural life, if you like, in a way that few of his other books have. This has survived as a title. The title, The Looking Glass War, is often used in articles and for headlines and stuff like that. But actual discussion of this book is close to nil, I would say, in the cultural world, which is quite interesting considering how close this is to The Spy Who Came From the Cold. Was it too uncompromising for the public? I think maybe it was.
The other part of it is, although it has Smiley, it isn't focused on Smiley. And once Tinker Tailor came out, I think that's where you really see the public kind of focused on those novels. And that's why this one falls out of favor a little bit.
Sure, but The Spy Who Came From the Cold hardly features Smiley and everyone, even post-Tinker Tailor, you know, accepts that that's a classic. And I mean, you know, this isn't as good a book as The Spy Who Came From the Cold. But I would say it's not far off. What's interesting about it is that if you accept its uncompromising nature, if you accept that it is a satire, that it isn't going to end in kind of victory snatched from the jaws of defeat in some way, that it is just going to be doomed. Just on a kind of page-by-page basis, the writing does hold up with the best of Le Carré. And I think there's a huge amount of brilliant writing in it. And I think there's also a lot of very dark humour in it, which maybe wasn't present in a lot of the other books.
Just to kind of wrap up some of this discussion about MI5 and 6 and Le Carré, we see this department versus the circus, and I know you mentioned it kind of being added later, but it does ring true to a certain extent that you have these rival departments that are kind of sniping at each other, and I'm sure that's one of the things that let Le Carré put it in, right? Because I'm sure he saw that between MI5 and MI6.
I mean, I think this is based on reality, which is that the department is essentially, he's imagined the Special Operations Executive continuing. And during the Second World War, MI6 and the Special Operations Executive were very bitter rivals, and they tread on each other's toes quite a lot. And this kind of ridiculous Machiavellian kind of maneuvering between them, lying to each other, took place quite a lot. I mean, famously or infamously, one SOE agent who is thought to have betrayed a network to the Germans claimed he was doing this as part of an MI6 operation to protect the secrets of D-Day. So you have these kind of very, very strange things going on. And at the end of the war, SOE wanted to continue, and they did continue for a while. They were shut down in 1946. So if you like, the real life control managed to put them to sleep and take over everything. So he's drawing on that hypothesis. Well, what if that hadn't happened and SOE had continued? And I think he's sort of saying some SOE officers joined MI6. And some just retired. But he, as a relatively young man in both MI5 and MI6, would have been very well aware of this history. And he would have heard an awful lot of people in the bar saying, well, we can't do special operations anymore like we could, you know, with SOE. And he's kind of saying, this is what it would have been like. This is what actually would have happened. There's no place for this. And it wouldn't have worked. And instead, the brilliant operation, even though doomed, of The Spy Who Came From the Cold, you would have had a complete failure of an operation. So I think that's some of the context. Obviously, MI5 and MI6 also had rivalry, but I think this is specifically about SOE. I think this is the only Le Carré book where we really see from start to finish this kind of espionage. Because you think of Lemus's job, that's an intelligence role. That's human intelligence. And here, this is about, as they say, putting a man in. And this is, it's a behind the enemy lines operation. It's special ops. This is actually a special ops operation. And I don't think Le Carré ever really looked at that again. He wasn't as interested in that kind of spying. What we normally think of is the Smiley type spying. We don't think of it as this man trying to cut through some barbed wire or get over a border with a radio set kind of spying. You don't really see that very much in Le Carré.
You see it in other of his books. The political wrangling between areas, I think, was really interesting in this, even as a late edition, just that back and forth. And you see Leclerc is going to the undersecretary and in kind of an amazing scene where he puts his years of political office warfare to use to just like maestro what he wanted. That was really great. I loved that scene.
I think that is a classic Le Carré scene, actually, because up until this point he's rather a pathetic figure, Leclerc. I mean, the whole setup of the office and how, you know, they're kind of bickering about their taxi expenses and we should get a car like Control has and all of this kind of thing. It's very, very sad, really, what they're doing. And you think this is an incompetent fool who's kind of been put out to pasture and got nothing to do. But then in that scene you suddenly realize, well, hold on, this guy's pretty wily. I mean, this is like incredibly Machiavellian. He's like Iago talking to Othello, and you know, he's underplaying the whole time the idea, but by underplaying the idea that there is any threat, he's saying there might be a real threat here. You know, it's an incredibly brilliant scene. He gets exactly what he wants by saying the opposite of what he wants. So it's like uber Le Carré. I think that is, like, if you haven't read this book and you love Le Carré, there are scenes in it like this which are really just totally classic Le Carré.
I agree, yeah. There's a few that I want to get to, especially that I think just push it to the top as far as, you know, some of the writing that he pulls off. There's one book that I've read. I don't know if you've ever read this. It's called Le Carré's Landscape. It's by a guy named Todd Hoffman.
No.
He worked in the Canadian SIS.
Okay.
He basically goes through the books with like an intelligence officer's eye. And one of the things that he found very interesting in the Looking Glass War was he saw a very real world connection between the CSIS and the Mounted Police and this back and forth where, you know, each of them is trying to jockey for position because they worry that, at least in the CSIS, they worry that they're kind of not useful and are going to be left behind by the Mounted Police, who are much more active. And it's almost the reverse of the department and the circus kind of thing where, you know, the Mounted Police are doing all of these active operations and the agent running stuff seems kind of secondary. But I recommend checking that one out. I thought he had some interesting things to say about Macari's intelligence kind of perspective.
Will do. But I think also that's very common, that kind of dynamic that we're all familiar with, you know, interdepartmental dynamics and these kind of politicking. And I think, I suppose, one of the reasons why this book didn't chime or hasn't had the longevity in the same way as The Spy Who Came In From the Cold is because Le Carré is sort of, he feels in this book almost ashamed at points that he's writing about espionage. I mean, there's lots of discussion of religion.
Lots and lots of, like, I was reading reviews before I started my reread, and I was like, and talking about, you know, the religious thing, and I'm like, oh, I'll keep an eye out for that. And I was like, oh, wait, no, I don't need to keep, like, mark it down. Like, at a certain point, you're like, oh, boy, wow.
Yeah, all over I think it's a flaw of the book, actually. I mean, I think some of the dialogue is not believable dialogue, especially towards the end. I don't think people talk like that. But I think there's a lot of talk of religion and faith and that kind of thing. And there's also a lot of parallels with academia. I mean, they pose the end as academics. You also have the whole discussion between Avery and Smiley where he's talking about Oxford and the greats and all this kind of stuff. But if you were to imagine that this book were written, the department was one Oxford college and that the circus were another Oxford college, and then they were all dons, and that you had the same wrangling between them of privilege and status and power, and the same kind of Machiavellian behind the scenes stuff, and the same betrayal and the same lying and the same, all of the same stuff, but just transpose that to the world of academia or religion or any other world, we wouldn't be interested because you don't have the stakes of another Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think what has put people off this book is that he's using the stakes, if you like, the cheap, sensational, melodramatic stakes of spy fiction, but he doesn't deliver on them because in the end, there's nothing there. So it then feels like we are in the world of academia or some other office politics because that threat didn't really exist. But I think that was his point. I mean, he wanted to do that. He wanted to do that. And it's very Graham Greene. It's very Graham Greene that as well.
What do they say? The fights in academia are so vicious because the stakes are so low.
Indeed.
Right?
Yeah, indeed. And so I think there's an element of that. And I think the religion stuff, I think, is very familiar from Graham Greene. But I think also the kind of atmosphere of the book feels not just like Our Man in Havana, which of course he then returned to with the Tale of Panama's inspiration even more than this one, but I think the whole kind of feeling of these people's lives, their marriages, their kind of day-to-day existences, they feel like very isolated, lonely figures who are all searching for some kind of cause. And I think that he's taken, you know, he's been very, very inspired by Greene.
To throw on, I guess, the psychologist hat for a little bit, I mean, it feels like Le Carre at this time, right, was doing some searching on his own, trying to figure out where he belonged and what he was doing. And so that feels like it kind of leached into this book.
Yeah, I don't think that's a leap at all. I mean, I think he's as much as said it. And this is very raw. This is straight after he's left. He's just left MI6, literally weeks before he starts writing this book. So I think the character of John Avery and his kind of bitter disappointment, his kind of searching for meaning in the book and the compromises that how he sees the department. He's the only character who has anything other than complete self-delusion in this book, I think, but ultimately does delude himself. And I think this is really Le Carre writing, what would have happened if I had stayed?
And you get the sense that after leaving MI6, he was searching because he had searched for so long to find a place and he'd finally kind of found it, right?
Yeah.
He spent time teaching. He was trying to make his way as an artist for a while. Then he's kind of doing this dabbling in writing. He works for MI5. He works for MI6. I mean, he's really on the hunt. And yes, he's had the success with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, but as all of the critics are quick to point out, you know, oh, he had the big success, can he do it again, right? That's what they all say, you know. He did it once, can he do it again? And there's this line, well, I'm sorry, he has not, in one of these reviews, I think, right, for a small town in Germany, which is like, ouch.
Yeah, but I think that he was quite bitter about the reception of this book, because I think he thought that it was as good, if not better, than The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. And you can kind of, I mean, it is an astonishing book. I mean, if you look at just how much, it's a very packed book. There's a lot more in it than you initially think. And yeah, I think the freedom of having left and having found his voice, I think he just thought, to hell with it, I'm just going to write exactly what I want to write. And that's what we have here.
And then his damn editors got involved, right? That's what he
well,
would say.
I mean, the idea that it was too bleak and too dark beforehand, I mean, this is as bleak and as dark. I mean, God knows what it must have been like. It must have been like really, really bleak, because this is pretty bleak.
Well, and let you know, I want to get into some of the characters here, because we talked a little bit about Avery and his terrible, terrible mission.
Yeah.
And just complete goof up on that one. But I guess if we have a lead, it's Avery, right? I mean, although I would make the case that although he's our view into everything, I think Lyser is the more compelling character, the more interesting character, to me at least. There's more going on there. And I just think Avery is very clear kind of to see through. I think you get a sense of the person he is. And Lyser is a little more tricky to figure out what's going on there. Yeah. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Yeah, I think I do, yeah.
And so Avery is in this kind of loveless marriage, and everybody is not in love with whoever they're with, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it, like we said, they're all searching for something, and Avery in particular is lost in this book.
Also, I think they don't love who they're with, but they also tell them their secrets, which I think is also what you were alluding to before about the idea that spies, you know, they always keep their secrets and they're very competent and all this stuff. He's pointing out, like, in reality, everyone tells their wife.
Well, if you want to have a wife, probably that's what you got to do, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see how his marriage has basically fallen apart. And she knows, his wife knows, that this is not where he should be if he wants to be healthy.
Yeah.
She says it again and again, you need to leave. And he knows it. At a certain point, he comes back from his mission and he's ready to call it quits, right?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that Sisman kind of draws a very direct line to Le Carre's own marriage at the time. And in fact, his wife at the time thought that depiction of Sarah was a depiction of her. And so I think he was certainly taking out some of that frustration. I mean, that's one of the lines that made me laugh out loud in the book, is that very early on he wakes her up and says, Taylor's been killed. And she says, what, does that happen often? And he says, I can't tell you, and so on. Then several chapters later, he comes back and she's ill with flu. And she says, and he's been very late. And she says, where have you been? Has someone else been murdered? And that's such a kind of dry line. But I can understand, why female critics might not have liked this, because, I mean, she's essentially a harridan. There aren't any sympathetic female characters really in this book.
Well, all of the female characters are there to shine a mirror back on the feet of clay of all of the male characters, right? And there's not much more for them to do.
No.
Avery has this kind of weird relationship with the secretary there as well. It's like, are they having an affair or not? It's
very weird.
There's this moment where he leans forward and puts his forehead on hers, right? Yeah. Isn't that it?
It's pretty creepy. It feels quite weird and quite creepy and quite inappropriate. It feels like they're kind of thinking of having it. He also writes a letter to her when he's in Finland, which he then kind of burns. But it's like, it's phrased, he wrote a letter to a woman. It might have been Carol. So it's a very odd, it feels quite peculiar, and that they don't really understand women. And I said, the women aren't sympathetic. I mean, none of the characters in this are actually very sympathetic, I don't think. I think Lysa is probably the character we have most sympathy with. But going back to the structure, it's different from a lot of Le Carré's, in that what he tended to do after this book was have a kind of central character, the Barley Blair character or the Jonathan Pine character, or the protagonist whose name I've forgotten now in Silverview. And that's our kind of like outsider character who, from their perspective, is then drawn into the world of intelligence. And we then see how that outsider deals with all of this kind of odd stuff that British intelligence get up to. Whereas here, we're introduced to the weird British intelligence people, and then halfway through, we meet Lysa. So although he is an outsider, we see him more through their eyes than his view of them. And his view of them is obviously warped. I mean, he's kind of half in love with Avery. Avery lies to him needlessly about his age. And then later on, when Lysa's over the border, he thinks, no, he must have said, I must have misheard. So he kind of justifies it to himself. So he's not the same kind of character as Le Carré would turn to, which would give us more of a lead, I think.
Well, and Avery and Lysa have this moment where they're walking, holding hands together through the park. And, nowadays that would maybe come across a little different. I don't know if it came across differently back then or not. The male relationships are odd. The male-female relationships are odd as well. They're just off. These are people who can't relate to each other. They're talking past each other a lot of the times as well.
And there's, I mean, I suppose that may be another reason why the book didn't do as well as it could do, because there's no love story. And again, that's quite rare for Le Carré. There's no Liz Gold, there's no Lizzie, there's no Jed. There's a girl in an inn in Germany, for a couple of hours. That and the hand-holding with Avery is as close as we get to any kind of warmth or human love in this book. So it's a book that has very little love in it. And I think, I said it, it's the In Utero, it's the third Nirvana album. I mean, this is meant to be uncompromising. This is meant to not satisfy popular tastes. And so it's not surprising in a way that by trying to be this pure, by getting rid of these kind of elements that maybe seemed to him to be cheap at the time, but which are actually pretty essential to fiction, that it had the life that it had.
Well, and what is the quote? Do you know what love is? I'll tell you. It is whatever you can still betray. Hitting things on the nose there
I don't think too many people say that kind of thing in real life. I mean, some of the speeches at the end, I think, feel very like speechifying. But having said that, there is dialogue like that in The Spy Who Came In From Nicole as well, which is very on the nose.
Talking about Avery's wife, there is a moment that did feel very true. This felt like a line that probably came from life, where she goes, for pity's sake, John, don't try and run me like one of your wretched agents. And I was recently speaking with somebody who worked at CIA, and they talked about how you'd have those people. They'd have to run agents. They'd have to manipulate their agents to get them to do something that's against their better nature. But then they couldn't turn it off, right? They'd turn it back on everybody else around them. And that felt very, very true to life. That's something that still goes on, probably.
And I think that does sound true to life. And also, of course, in reality, I mean, Le Carré's wife at this time, she was also trying to be a writer. Often these intelligence officers, who were all men, you could not be one if you're a woman. It was basically unheard of outside the war. They were the kind of, you know, behind every great man is a great woman. I mean, they were telling their wives all sorts of stuff, and their wives had very perceptive sometimes things to say about it. So that does feel like if you're an intelligence officer and you've married a woman who is as clever as you are, and she's heard a lot about your job, she might well be able to sense what you're trying to do. And she's probably knows just as much how to manipulate people as you do. He's been in publishing, we know. He's only 30. Well, I can't remember now, is he 32 or 34? But he's not very old. Yeah. And he hasn't got any intelligence experience. And they're all sort of trying to, all of the characters, the male characters, are trying to hype up how important this is. So there's a great bit with Woodford, where he's with his wife, and she sort of demands, you know, what's happening. And again, a little bit like Leclerc, where he sort of wins all of the equipment by denying that there's any problem. He deliberately says, well, maybe nothing's happening. Nothing's happening at all. And of course, then she gets, you know, more and more interested. And then she, you know, says, tell me, you know, and he says, we're putting a man over the border. It was his moment of victory. I'm in charge of the London end. There's a crisis. There could even be a war. It's a damn ticklish thing. The match had gone out, but he was still swinging it up and down with long movements of his arm, watching her with triumph in his eyes. I mean, he's talking about the possibility of a nuclear war, but he's delighted because he's incredibly important. And of course, Avery's wife sees through this. No one knows their husband as well as a wife, I think.
That little bit there puts a finger on something that we see even now, right? Because as all of this is spinning up, there's this talk of the department now. They've opened the front doors. He's got this car now. Leclerc can drive around in. Avery comes back and he talks about how things look spruced up somehow. Like just this action has brought the whole place to life again, right? And you see that anytime that there's some sort of crisis where there's, you know, these bureaucracies leap to life. No matter the reality of them at all, right? And the crisis is what makes you useful, right?
No, indeed. They have no use whatsoever. And then suddenly, and he says the same thing about Leclerc, suddenly he seems like a different man. And he's obviously not as pathetic. And I mean, Le Carré made a direct comparison between this book and the Iraq War later in his life, the, you know, dodgy dossier, as it was called. And that basically intelligence officers can get excited. So, I mean, he's saying The Spy Who Came In From the Cold is an example of an incredibly clever, elaborate operation that succeeds. What happens when they go wrong? What happens when they get all excited and have all of this kind of stuff, but they don't know what they're doing and the thing isn't successful? But you still have the same outward. He's still driving. He's got a chauffeur with the same car as Control. But Control, we know, and Smiley actually know what they're doing. And operationally know what they're doing. I mean, in any kind of, if you take like detective drama, you always have like a character who, he might be quite annoying, or she, but often it's a he. So Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot, Father Brown, Smiley, they might be flawed and they might have all sorts of problems at home or any number of frailties, but they're brilliant and they're going to succeed and they're going to get the job done. And they're surrounded by mediocre people, people who aren't as brilliant as them, who they don't have any time for, which is partly why they're kind of rude, you know, the Lestrades of the world. We're not interested in following a kind of second-rate detective. Hercule Poirot is the best detective. Sherlock Holmes is that they have to be the best detective. And Smiley is the best spy. He's the best spy hunter. And so this, suddenly we're seeing the back room of all of these other guys who aren't Smiley, like all the people who he's had to deal with in their center stage. So in that way, I think this has been, you can probably tell where I'm going, but I think this has been a big influence because I think this is a kind of early incarnation of Mick Herron's Slow Horses, because we have a kind of bunch of misfit spooks, you know, who are out of the circle and desperate to get back some of their inner, you know, some of the glory that they had before, fighting impossible battles to kind of persuade themselves that they have some worth in the world.
Well, and not the case in this book, but I do think that there's obviously more relatability to that for the reader, don't you think?
There is, and it's interesting that it isn't very relatable in this book. I think it's partly to do with the fact that in Mick Herron's series, the characters are much more self-aware. They cannot get away from the fact that they're failures. So in this book, when their wives tell them that they're failures, they kind of fight back and they say, we're not. There's about to be a war. This is really big stuff. It's finally happening. Even though Avery...
It's finally happening. Finally, yes. Yeah, we got the war. Yes.
No, but I mean, there is... And Avery kind of knows that it's fake. And it's clear Haldane knows it's fake. I mean, he finds these files in his office. You know, he's been given by his assistant. And he goes through and he realizes, you know, clearly this must be fabricated intelligence. There's a clear record of it. But he persuades himself that it isn't. So they all are kind of deluding themselves. Avery has this moment of doubt where he spills it all out and says, I don't believe the intelligence. I don't believe any of this is real. I don't think we have the capability. We should give it to the circus. And then he recants because, you know, you have to believe in all this kind of thing that he's given a speech by Leclerc. Whereas in the Slough House series, in the Slow Horses series, Jackson Lamb makes it very clear to them all, you're failures. That's why you're here. You're useless. You know, he drums it home to them every hour of the day. They know perfectly well that they are outside. They've been cast out. Whereas here, they don't want to admit it. And that's harder to sympathize with, I think.
Yeah, I think you've put your finger on why this book is so hard to wrap your head around because of its bleakness. And with that thought, I'm going to pause things here. We're going to come back for part two of our look at the Looking Glass War. I'll have links to various things discussed today in the show notes and on the episode page at lacarecast.com. If you enjoyed the show, you would be doing a huge favor by subscribing and reviewing it on whatever podcast app you use to listen. It will help all of those other Le Carre fans find us and give us a shot. You can drop a comment on the website or on Twitter at Le Carre Cast and follow me as I talk about non-Le Carre stuff on SpyWrite.com or SpyWrite on Twitter. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Hello, my name is Chris Carter, filmmaker and podcaster. Join me as I take a look at the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and organized crime on my podcast, Secrets and Spies, available on all podcast apps.
This is Manna from Spy Heaven.
Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.